Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Maybe it's not news to you that America is the most stressed out country in the world. That, according to one expert, the average high school kid today has the same level of anxiety as the average psychiatric patient in the early 1950s. The question is, why? And further, should we passively accept the scourge of fear and anxiety that we live with every day, or actively embrace the process to change the outcome? That's what author Taylor Clark wanted to know when he set out to write a book on the topic last year. Taylor Clark is a writer based in Portland, Oregon. His first book is called Starbucked, A Double Tall Tale of Caffeine Commerce and Culture. His new book is called Nerve, Poise Under Pressure, Serenity Under Stress, and the Brave New Science of Fear and Cool. Welcome to the show, Taylor Clark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Question for listeners, has fear done you in or helped you out? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, and share your story. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to Facebook page. You can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. So, Taylor, you say that you suffer from anxiety yourself, and that's what led you to write the book in the first place. And I wanted to know, first of all, did it help?
Did writing the book help? Well, okay. I would have to say that at the time, certainly, it didn't feel like it was helping, because the last thing that an anxious person wants to do is spend a couple of years thoroughly immersed in every possible study and finding about anxiety. So it was definitely challenging, and I definitely had more than my fair share of anxiety while writing it. But I think of it now as kind of a trial by fire experience. And, you know, if for nothing else, the best thing that probably came out of the book for me personally was realizing that, you know, since I am actually proud of the book that I came up with, the best thing that came out of it was seeing that I could, along with my own anxieties and fears and stress, create something that I was proud of, you know, that we could work together and create something that I thought was pretty cool.
Sort of like, if it doesn't kill you, it'll make you stronger?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, more than that, just realizing that, you know, you described fear and anxiety as a scourge and said that I suffered from fear and anxiety just a moment ago, and you know, that's actually, after writing this, a formulation that I try not to think of. I try not to think of fear and anxiety in negative terms, because, as we'll probably get to, fear and anxiety are trying to help you. You know, they're trying to help you survive. You know, they're there to help you, you know, prepare for the future, and there to help you, you know, run from menacing bears and get out of the way of the oncoming bus and things like that. And so, you know, they're there to be worked with, not worked against. And the more that we think of them as enemies, kind of the deeper into this hole we dig ourselves.
My guest is Taylor Clark. He's a writer based in Portland, Oregon. He's the author of Nerve, Poise Under Pressure, Serenity Under Stress, and the Brave New Science of Fear and Cool. Something that really grabbed me in the book in the introduction was the idea that, yes, fear is our friend. It's hardwired into us to protect us from, you know, the mastodon charging through the forest, but that it wasn't meant to help us cope with whether the boss likes us or not, and the things that keep us awake at night, our jobs, our kids, our pets. I mean, whatever sort of thing that keeps us one awake at night, it wasn't necessarily, you know, didn't come about because of that. And so it doesn't work the same way.
Right. Yeah. You know, fear springs from this little tiny almond shaped organ in our brain called the amygdala. And basically the amygdala is this vigilant watchdog inside your brain whose job is to sense potential threats. And then, without even any input from the conscious mind, to motivate a fear response, which is, you know, the classic fight or flight or freeze reaction, to get you out of the way of danger. And so that works really well when you've got, like, the mastodon that you talked about. You've got this clear threat where it's something that's, you know, an actual mortal danger, and, you know, having that adrenaline reaction, that, you know, juiced up muscles and being on edge, that actually helps you get out of the way of physical danger. But when you're talking about things like, you know, you're worried you're going to be fired at work, or, you know, any of the other little niggling fears of modern life, that reaction really is not too helpful. And in fact, you know, you mentioned that America is the most anxious nation in the world, and that the anxiety rates seem to be rising. And, you know, part of the reason for that is really that we're dealing with kind of a fear system that hasn't changed since the days of our caveman ancestors, and that, you know, it, which kind of ups the ante to help that we need to figure out how to learn how to deal with our fear systems in a way that's more productive for the modern era, I guess you could say.
Why is it that America's ranked the most anxious nation on the planet? In other words, you know, I know maybe compared to some less technological societies but why is it so much worse than, say, Germany or the UK or something like that?
You know, it's hard to say comparatively why it's worse. That statistic is basically based on public health information.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can just say that the reason that America is doing poorly in anxiety is, I mean, experts, there's no one opinion, because if you ask experts, as I did, they have a lot of different responses. So one of those responses, which wouldn't surprise a whole lot of people, is sort of information overload effect, because, as has been said many times, humans now, between different devices and television and magazines and newspapers, are taking in a lot more information than they ever have. And I think that's especially true in America, you know, where we're constantly wired in. And our brains were just kind of not designed to deal with that level of information. And it's been said before that the average Sunday newspaper contains more raw information than early humans would take in over the course of several years. So, and a lot of that information that we're getting is of kind of a worrying, alarming variety of, you know, the 10 o'clock news, you know, variety of the hidden threat in your own home and all of that. You know, we live in a culture where fear is kind of used to motivate us. So, and then there's the fact, too, that as some people I talked to have pointed out, we kind of live in a feel-good culture where we are just not exactly in touch with how to deal with our own fears. You know, we kind of have a national, I guess, preoccupation with optimizing our own state at any time. And so we are much more inclined than ever before to use medication and other ways to numb how we feel, which actually is something that affects developing world nations a lot less than they suffer. Even though, you know, life is a whole lot more tough in a place like Nigeria or Mexico, those places show anxiety rates that are literally about 20% of ours.
Another kind of shocking point you made is the average high school kid today has the same level of anxiety as the average psychiatric patient in the early 1950s, and that sounds like a bona fide public health issue.
It is. And it is. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, I mean, as a mother of an average high school kid.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's true. It's hard to, kids especially, it seems to be, this is not something that I research specifically as much, how anxiety affects young people, but mm-hmm. It's definitely been shown that kids are getting more anxious at a younger age. And there are many arguments that can be made for where that comes from, like the fact that, you know, the information overload effect might have a major effect on developing brains. Also, I mean, kids especially are saturated in information. But, yeah, it's a pretty alarming statistic.
You write about the nervous trinity, fear, anxiety, and stress. What's the difference?
Well, you know, we tend to think of those things as interchangeable, but at least to psychologists and neuroscientists, they're very different. So fear is the body's response to a danger that is right in front of you right now. So fear is the response that you get, the fight or flight reaction to that mastodon charging at you, and you need to get out of the way or fight. probably get out of the way in that case. But anxiety is a little different because anxiety is more of a cognitive phenomenon. Anxiety is, rather than being about what's happening right now, anxiety is about what ifs and what might happen in the future, which anxiety tends to be more of the modern disease because really, unless you're living in a very dangerous place, you're not going to have a lot of incidents that cause you real fear in your daily life. Anxiety, thinking about the future, worrying, ruminating tends to be what we go through. And stress is just kind of the body's reaction to demanding circumstances. So stress is a little bit harder to define, but it's kind of a catch-all for the demands that we have trouble coping with in life. And the body is kind of built up reaction to that.
You compare, and in the title and elsewhere, fear to cool, which does suggest the physical manifestation of fear, heat.
Mm-hmm. You know, to be honest with you, I hadn't actually thought about that. I guess I guess that cool, I can tell you that one of the things that I found out about cool in writing this is that it's a lot less different than from fear than you might think. It's a lot less literally cool than you might think, because we have this impression with cool people who are able to be cool under pressure, who can cope with any kind of circumstances with ease. And what people who have researched them have found out is that, you know, rather than being perfectly calm, they oftentimes are just as afraid or more afraid than the rest of us in the same circumstances. They're just dealing with it differently. They're not preoccupied with the fear. They're not fighting against it, and they're focusing on what they need to do in that moment. You know, I guess one of the surprising things is that being cool under pressure is not necessarily a phenomenon of being, you know, ice cold. They can oftentimes be as hot as the rest of us, but just better at dealing with it.
And not ironically, you talk about a case at the very beginning of the book. It's the guys in the Russian submarines headed to Cuba during the Bay of Pigs crisis. Tell us about that and what happened in that case. It's really, I'd never really heard much about that before. I was interested.
Yeah, it was the the beginnings of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there were famously a set of submarines that Russia had sent over in convoy to Cuba, and they were antiquated subs. They were not equipped for warm weather. They were equipped for cold weather, obviously. And they had them sail all the way from Russia down to the tropics. And when it got out that these submarines were on the way, of course, Kennedy famously said that the U.S. Navy would spare no expense in finding them. And so when they finally did, the American Navy finds these overmatched subs and assumes that there is nothing, that there are no real threat. And what they did not know is that as they were harassing these subs to get them to come up and essentially making the people inside these submarines think that World War III was about to happen, because the people inside the submarines had no communication from Moscow. They had no idea that anything really was going wrong. And what the Americans did not know is they were basically dropping depth charges on these submarines to get them to come to the surface, was that they were carrying nuclear warheads with very liberal instructions to use them. So on the submarine that I talked about, the commander of the submarine, and this was a story that wasn't even really well known until a few years ago. It's not well known now, but it wasn't known at all until a few years ago. The commander of this Russian submarine decided to launch a nuclear warhead because he thought from what was going on that the Americans were attacking. And he was very close. His figure wasn't exactly over the red button, but he was very close. And what basically saved the horrible catastrophe from happening was this older gentleman named Valentin Savitsky, who was traveling on that submarine, was kind of the voice of reason. And he took this commander aside and he talked to him calmly. And he kind of talked him down off the ledge and got him to come up and talk to the Americans, because I think he realized that, you know, the negative effects of launching would be so vast. And so he was the voice of reason. He was kind of a manifestation of how cool under pressure can make all of the difference.
My guest is Taylor Clark. We're talking about his book, Nerve, Poise Under Pressure, Serenity Under Stress, and the Brave New Science of Fear and Cool. If you have a story to tell about how your nerves have gotten the best of you or how you've managed to work with your nerves, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. 38 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine this afternoon with a few clouds and a high near 50 degrees. Clouds for tonight, a low of 35, some rain possible tomorrow, and a high of 43. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of rain and a low near freezing. And then partly cloudy on Sunday with a high right around 45.
The law firm of Bailey Cavalieri supports equality programming on WOSU Public Media and is proud to support the Columbus Neighborhoods Project. It's the story of determined pioneers, devastating floods, a vision for a state capital, flourishing theaters, churches, and businesses. A look at what life's like today for people moving back downtown and for families who've been in Franklinton for five generations. Learn more when WOSU TV presents Columbus Neighborhoods Downtown Franklinton, airing Tuesday, February 14th at 8 p.m. only on WOSU TV.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Taylor Clark. We're talking about his book, Nerve, Poise Under Pressure, Serenity Under Stress, and the Brave New Science of Fear and Cool. Have a story about how fear has impacted your life? Give us a call. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, Taylor. You mentioned fight or flight, and to that you added freeze, the fight or flight or freeze. And we've all heard of fight or flight, but the freeze part, when I was reading about that in the book, it did make me think about I have a new coat, and when I take walks in the morning in the park, it makes a sound, but you can barely hear it. But it's a different sound than any other sound, and I've noticed that all of a sudden I just stop, and I don't even know why I've stopped, but I think there's something around, and something's happened, and then I stop, and I listen, and then I hear that tapping noise, and it's like a zipper tapping on the coat, and I go, oh, it's that. But I really couldn't hear it consciously.
Fear, more than most things that we encounter in daily life psychologically, is a system that acts totally beyond our conscious control and awareness. And so times like that, when we see ourselves freeze, we do it all the time. You know, we'll have the startle reflex when a door slams that we're not afraid of, and we'll jump up, and, you know, it's something we didn't choose to do. So, that happens all the time, where we get, we have a fear reaction that, you know, kind of startles us in its speed. But, you know, the freeze reaction is basically, we know about fighting or flighting with fear, but freeze deserves to be in that conversation too, because, you know, when we encounter a threat, sometimes it's good to run, sometimes it's good to fight. But at other times, and you see this with deer a lot, for example, the best option actually is to stop, and, you know, you freeze in place, you become a statue, your breath stops, your eyes get wide, and you just listen and wait, because really, in the wild, a lot of the time for prey or for, you know, in times of danger, when you encounter, say, you know, a jaguar in the jungle, it's best to stop and just kind of hope that you didn't actually get noticed, that if you become frozen, that whatever it is, the threat will just keep moving and not attack you. So it's actually a defense reaction that we do, you know, just as much as deer in the forest.
Right. Unfortunately, the deer, likewise, with us, their fear mechanisms to stop and listen kills them more often than not.
Right.
Because it has to do with the car.
Yeah, you know, and that happens, unfortunately, with humans, too, on occasion. It's much more rare, but an example that I use in my book is there's this reaction. It's called tonic immobility, where humans have a freaking reaction that is something that becomes a little bit more pronounced and beyond their control. And so an example of when that happened was during the Virginia Tech massacre, when the unhinged gunman came to Virginia Tech and started going classroom by classroom. And a lot of people in those classrooms survived or just reported that afterwards they had the strange experience where rather than running or fighting, they froze and they became almost completely unable to move. And sometimes, you know, they actually like fell to the ground as if they'd been shot. And in some cases, I think that actually, you know, it can save people because just like with the predator we were talking about, it makes it seem like they're playing dead. But it's not a choice that they made. It's a choice that their fear mechanism made.
You tell a funny story about a certain kind of reptile
mm-hmm.
or snake, how it does this very elaborate death scene.
yeah, you know, and I'm,
that's really funny.
The snake's name is not
tip of your tongue,
not coming
yeah.
offhand, but there's a certain species of snake that when it is under threat, it writhes. Like, you can watch a video clip of it on YouTube, and it writhes around as if it's been inflicted with the most horrible poison known to the universe, and it coils up and it flops over and its tongue hangs out, and it even it's so pronounced this reaction that it will actually emit little drops of what looks like blood on the idea that, you know, of course you don't want to eat a snake that's been this poisoned. And it's silly because, you know, if you try to flip the snake back over, then the snake will like insistently go back to being dead. It'll flip itself back over really quickly as if to say, like, no, seriously, I'm dead.
It's a very funny story.
Yeah.
Michelle in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit about how I used to work for Meyer in loss prevention. And when I first started with them, it was the thing I had to overcome the most was apprehending people, and that was the approach of them and confronting them and saying, you know, I believe that you've taken something. And it was almost
immobilized you, yeah,
yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And my coworkers would actually have to push me in front of the person to kind of get me to do my job. And I was wondering, what does it take? Because eventually I was very comfortable, and I was able to overcome my own fear and do my job very well and not even think about it, and confronting people became sort of second nature to me. What happens in that process that we are able to force ourselves to go from not being able to do something with fear and to being able to do something?
Yeah, well, I think that what you're describing is the experience of getting over a fear, which is something that we talk about a lot. And we talk about how people need to get over their fears. But one of the things that I discuss in my book is how nobody ever really tells you how to do that. And nobody really ever tells you how that works. So what happens in a case like that is that you have a fear, and that fear memory lives in your amygdala, which is the part of the brain that I talked about before. And what happens when you confront that fear is that over time, through exposure, through experience, you show your brain, this kind of part of your unconscious mind, that in this situation, it's okay, you don't need to have a fear reaction. And you can't do that consciously. One of the things that's interesting about fear is that it's really hard to talk ourselves down from fear. We can't rationally tell ourselves, like, no, don't feel afraid, it's okay. Anybody who's, you know, been afraid of flying and has heard, you know, all the statistics about how flying is safe, you know, that's not usually very comforting. So the way to get over a fear is to expose yourself to what it is that makes you afraid. And over time, that part of your mind puts it together on its own. That, like, no, I'm not going to die. No, I'm not going to be hurt if I do this. I can handle this. And so that's probably what would happen in your case.
Well, to a certain extent, isn't it, too, that your desire, Michelle, to get, earn a living?
Yes,
your desire to eat?
Yeah, it was just very interesting to kind of wake up one day and realize I'm not feeling the same way that I did before, and I didn't quite understand how that had evolved. So that's interesting that it was a subconscious thing, something I was unaware of that just happened.
Yeah, it's the benefit of experience. I mean, that's what it boils down to, is how a lot of people who are cool under pressure, their brain just over time has just built up a kind of network of the right reactions under stressful situations. So they don't even have to really think about it, and they learn over time that, you know, they can handle it. And so I think that's a very common experience.
Taylor, is this something that we can see in brain scans, these changes over time, or have they not been able to do that yet?
Well, it's been a very thoroughly researched phenomenon neurologically, yes. There have been, one of the interesting things about studying fear is that up until about 25 years ago, none of what we're talking about was really known. And it wasn't until the work of a guy named Joseph Ledoux, a neuroscientist, that we even knew where the fear reaction came from in the brain, in this place called the amygdala. So this is one of those things where, you know, modern neuroscience is actually uncovering things that are instrumentally very valuable to, especially to anybody who has to deal with fear, is that suddenly, for the first time, we have a very clear understanding of the phenomenon of fear, exactly how it comes about, and exactly how to help deal with it. So yeah, this is, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done in kind of sussing out the exact neurological phenomena at work. But yeah, this is all something that, these are all things that we can see right before us in brain scans and things.
Michelle, thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks.
Take care. 614-292-8513. If you have an experience about how fear changed your life or how you managed it or not, give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org from Sarah in Clintonville. She says, my fear reaction is to gasp. I am a huge gasper, and my husband hates it. He never knows if something is really wrong or if I am just overreacting. I will gasp as I stub my toe on the table. I will gasp if I break a dish, and I will gasp if a car pulls out in front of us. My husband says the situation does not scare him. It is my gasp that is his trigger, but I can't control the gasping.
Yeah. Well, you know, the gasp is actually part of the startle reflex where we talked about before, where what happens when you get startled is that your eyes go wide so that you can see everything, you know, your hearing suddenly becomes acute, and you actually take in that breath really fast to stop the noise of your breathing. You know, when you get startled, like we talked about, and you freeze, you take that quick breath, and that's to, like, provide yourself with oxygen while at the same time, you know, going completely silent so that you can't be detected. And one of the interesting things about that, and perhaps the listener can tell her husband of this, is that the startle reflex is totally beyond our control. This is something that police departments have learned the hard way, because a lot of police departments have tried to train the startle reflex out of their officers, because there are actually a lot of negative consequences to the startle reflex in officers, especially if an officer is holding a gun and happens to get startled. And one of the parts of the startle reflex is that when we get afraid, we tend to clinch, ball up our fists, you know, to prepare to fight, essentially. And if you do that while you're holding a gun, you might just pull the trigger. So despite every effort that has been made to to train out the startle reflex, it's just not possible. So you know, the startle is beyond your control, and I think the listener's husband will probably just have to deal with it.
So, Sarah, there you go. Tell your husband There you go. Stephen Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you for having me on and enjoying the show.
Thank you.
I have a story to tell you how a fear led me to something. I was a senior, I think, in high school, and grew up in a small town, and we were having a Bible study in an apartment. And one of the kids looked out the window and said, "Isn't that a tornado, Steve?" And this was the year all those tornadoes went through Ohio. I said, "Yeah, it looks like one." So they immediately evacuated us from the apartment to a church basement. And all I could think of was my family in the house, so I prayed for them that the tornado would skip it. And I was very fearful. Well, after the alarm stopped and told us we could go home, I drove home as fast as I could to the area where my parents' house was. But the sheriff was there, and I saw a couple houses blown away 500 yards from our house, and I couldn't get in or see it. So I went to the back way down a mud road to my parents' house, and it was there with only a hole in the siding. And I talked to my father, and he said he watched the house get blown away 500 yards from him, and the tornado skipped 100 yards from the house. Now, this is something that hit me. You know, I really wasn't in contact of a higher power until I started thinking about somebody else other than myself. And it helped me grow anyways, and it helped me connect to a higher power than myself.
What about that? The fear isn't always just about yourself. It's about someone else, too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, what you're talking about is a very common experience. I mean, there are no atheists in foxholes, right? I mean, when we become afraid, it becomes a natural tendency to kind of reach to, you know, part of fear, honestly, is feeling that we have no control. That is one of the main motivators of anxiety. Because if we have control over situations, we seldom have, you know, cause to fear it. But more to the point of the community angle, one of the things that I found that was really, I thought, inspiring and ennobling about fear is that the sort of community bonds, the bonds that we have with other people, are by far and away the most powerful motivator, the most powerful thread that leads us through fear and leads us to do our best in those situations. There is a gentleman that I talked to named Alex Horton, who is in the army in Iraq, and he described to me about how he, you know, in platoons and units, army units, all over the world since, you know, since the dawn of time, basically, men had this powerful instinct to, despite how afraid they might be, it's far, far more distasteful to them across the board to let their comrades down, to let their brothers in arms down. And so what a lot of people find is that the bonds that they have with other people are so overwhelmingly strong that they can overcome even the deepest fear.
Steve, thanks for sharing that story. We appreciate it. By the way, Steven on Facebook says that the snake you were talking about, that we were chuckling about, is a hognose snake.
Hognose snake. I was going to say that, but I didn't want to.
You weren't quite sure. Hognose snake, I'm going to, right after the show, go check it out on YouTube.
It's very funny.
And maybe folks out there can do it while we're on break and let us know what they think. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hey, did you hear car talk last week?
The good news is you don't have to be in motion when you do this. You're going to grab on the frame and you're going to go, and you're going to pull that frame for the window close to your chest.
And think about how much snow's going to get in the vehicle.
From the bottom.
No, when there's no door there.
Oh, when you break, no,
when you break the door.
I would don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for car talk.
And car talk begins tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here with All Sides. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, All Sides Weekend begins with host Marilyn Smith and a discussion of the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. Join us for our restaurant panel beginning at 11 on All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating our nationally ranked businesses and nonprofit leaders, making our community stronger. With donors and funds in 33 Ohio counties, the Columbus Foundation, where your philanthropy and your community come together.
38 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine today and a few clouds, a high near 50. Clouds for tonight and a low of 35 degrees. Rain is possible tomorrow, a high of 43, and partly cloudy with highs in the mid-40s for Sunday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about fear with Taylor Clark. He's the author of the book Nerve, Poise Under Pressure, Serenity Under Stress, and the Brave New Science of Fear and Cool. If you have a question or comment for Taylor, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you. Two things. Some of us, and I'm one of them, kind of enjoy being a little bit afraid. It gets the feel-good stuff in my brain flowing, the adrenaline, serotonin, et cetera. And Andrew Swabel, who used to be on the faculty at Iowa State one time, I heard him say, life is like a violin string with too much stress and it breaks, but without some stress, there's no music. Now, that's really appropriate for the way I feel.
Yeah, you know, there is a whole subset of people who is kind of foreign to more neurotic people like myself who have been studied pretty thoroughly nowadays, the thrill-seeking contingent. And I am not one of them per se, but the thing that I found interesting about thrill-seekers, and I should say that I agree with you, I would never, ever in a million years want to live without fear. I think that, and that's basically the main point of my book, is that this is something that's there to help us. So as a general rule, I agree with you. But there are many people who actively seek out the feeling of fear because and adrenaline. And what I thought was interesting is that they have a completely different reaction to these situations than more anxious people do or more controlling people do, which is that in uncertainty, which tends to drive anxious people crazy, they see possibility. You know, they see all of the things that could happen that are great, whereas anxious people are preoccupied with the things that could go wrong. You know, they tend to have, people who are thrill seekers tend to feel a lot of control over situations. Like they have a lot of confidence in their ability to navigate situations, and that makes it exciting, whereas more anxious people tend to feel flustered in those situations. So what's cool is that, you know, for those people who can't get out of bed without the idea of jumping out of a plane later on, they're experiencing the world in a completely different way.
Thank you, Jim. 614-292-8513, if you want to make that call right now. The idea you make, the fear is a good thing, and that there are some people, though, that have had that amygdala altered in their brain. They don't feel fear at all, and it often happens. Well, it's a big risk with brain surgery and that sort of a thing.
Sure.
How do they operate?
Well, see, this is one of the things that I think helps you to realize just how important fear is and how it really is not our enemy for those who deal with fear and anxiety a lot, which is that without fear, we can't function. Those people who have had their amygdalas removed, or not removed, but they've been disabled through, you know, some misfortune, those people are barely functional. And the reason that is the case is because though we don't know it, and though we kind of tend to think that somebody like Spock, who is purely rational, would be better at navigating the world, the fact is that in almost any decision we might make, we need a little burst of emotion to help push us in the right direction. So what happens with these people who cannot feel fear is that they have trouble making even the smallest decisions. They go to the grocery store and they're not sure which variety of jelly to buy. And they'll sit there and they'll think of the pluses and minuses for 20 minutes. Because what we rely on, even though we don't know it, is this little burst, this little tiny tug of aversion or that we get that helps us push us in the right direction and gives us, you know, gives us guidance. It's like our compass. And so, you know, fear in a bunch of different ways is instrumental to our lives in ways that we don't realize.
Bruce in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment, but just on what you were saying, there's a movie called I Am Fishhead that talks about stockbrokers on antidepressants that don't feel the fear that they actually should be feeling when they're dealing with millions of dollars. My comment was to get over a fear in an opposite manner, like a soldier that you see in the movies that say, well, today's a good day to die, or for example, the security person who would actually be angry at the person and be sort of assaultive and eventually learn how to confront someone calmly. I myself am learning to be more assertive than assaultive. And how do you, show or, you know, what's the lesson to learn when you, you know, give care to the wind and just go at your fear, and then learn eventually that the fear is really not there and you don't need to be so aggressive?
Well, the fear is there, and that's, but I think the difference, the important thing to learn is that the fear is there, but that's fine. As I said a lot earlier in the show, there really is no difference. If there have been plenty of studies that have been done of people who are really high performers, who are very cool under pressure, who come through in the clutch, you know, the Tom Brady's of the world. And what these studies have found is that between the elite performers and the lower down performers who don't succeed as much, they feel the exact same amount of fear. There really is no difference in the amount of physical fear they feel. The only difference is in how they approach that. And so the people who are better at performing under pressure happen to just be the people who don't get preoccupied with their fear. They don't fight against it. They kind of recognize the patterns of, and this is true, I think, in being assertive or being good at dealing with fear in your own life, is that you kind of recognize the patterns of worry that you get into and just kind of accept them as the natural process of life rather than getting bound up with worry. And so I think the people who are best at dealing with this kind of thing are the people who accept their fear and kind of live in harmony with it and don't view it as a negative thing that needs to be combated against. And pretty soon what you find is that when you focus on doing the right thing, when you focus on the moment that's there right now rather than worrying, you find that before you even know it, you've become radically better at dealing with those situations. So I don't know if that's a very good answer to your question, but that's what comes to mind.
Thank you, Bruce, for that call. We're going to turn to Donnie now in Dayton. Welcome to the show, Donnie.
Yes. Hi, Anne. Hi, Taylor. I am enjoying the show, and it would be nice. I hope more people are watching this, but, you know, if you're nervous or if you're anxious, you're too scared, you're too busy freaking out to pay attention. So I have a suggestion as far as how to manage anxiety, and I picked this up from a counselor. This was years ago in college. My thing was always, what if? What if I don't do well on this test, or what if I can't pay this bill, or what if I don't find a job? A lot of times, and I still do this to this day, I have to answer the question. I can't say this works for everyone, but this has worked for me. So if I had a question, well, what if I don't do well on a test? I would answer the question. I'd say, okay, I don't do well on the test, I'll study a little harder next time and do better on the next one. Or if I can't pay this bill, or, you know, what if I can't pay this bill? It's like, well, you know, do what you can to make an arrangement, or however you have to answer the question. I guess the point is, that is the way that I learned I figured out how to manage whatever anxiety I had about a situation. I do have a question, however. This just came to me. If you're anxious, and this is for Taylor, if you're anxious, do you believe this is something that you are born with? Is this something that you, it peaks, or, you know, at certain points of your life or certain periods of your life, do you ever have a moment where you level out? Is there any sort of evidence that kind of points into the direction that if you're anxious, you learn how to deal with it? If you have high levels of anxiety, you learn how to deal with it, and it's sort of situational. And I'll take my answer offline. Thanks,
Donnie.
Sure. It's beyond question that part of the disposition towards anxiety is inherited. It's really hard to get a percentage down on how much of that is innate, but it's definitely there. But the fact also remains that probably anxious people are more highly represented in, you know, successful, cool under pressure people than anyone would really expect. I mean, you talk to performers, and so many of them get almost debilitating stage fright. Like Laurence Olivier, a lot of people don't realize that even though he was considered the greatest stage actor of his generation, he had stage fright that was almost disabling, and yet he kind of soldiered through it and eventually got over it. So yes, you know, you can never really tell. Some people who are extremely anxious get wound up over, you know, the biggest things. I'm actually kind of like this, is that I can become anxious and neurotic over small things, but then when an actual crisis happens, I am completely cool sometimes. So everybody's got their own little formula. But also, I wanted to address what you said about worrying and answering the question. And however you can learn to deal with it, I think is great. But worry is an interesting thing, because maybe as you found out, you don't win arguments with your own worries. It's an unending cycle. And what psychologists generally recommend, and I think this is very true, is that it's a lot of the time it's better to look at those worries that you get, you know, what if I don't do well on this test? And rather than kind of engaging in the debate where you agree, like, yes, this would be awful, it would be horrible, I couldn't deal with it, you just kind of watch the worry happen. You just kind of say, okay, and sort of let it float by. It gets compared to being mindful and to kind of looking at your worries and kind of watching them pass by like clouds. And that, too, you know, without kind of like putting yourself in a pitched battle against your own worries, that too can help you kind of gain a measure of control over the situation, where the worries that you have are not running your mental agenda. But you can also answer, I think, as the caller mentioned, you can also, when you have a worry come up, you can answer in a positive way rather than and being aware that you would cope with it, because all the evidence shows that people cope with their worries far, far better than they actually expect.
Jill in Westerville. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have, a two-part reason for my call. The first is just really a comment on how I deal with fear and anxiety in my work as a veterinarian. And the second is in kind of an observation and question about the role of fear in the lives of my husband and my son, who are both on the autism spectrum.
Hey, Jill, I don't want to interrupt. We are running out of time, though.
Okay.
If you could focus on one of those.
Well, as a veterinarian, I'm drawn, I would rather talk about my son and my husband. There are a lot of people that are looking at autism from a lot of different angles, but somebody is currently looking at it in terms of empathy. Traditionally, we've thought of people with autism without empathy, but in fact, they may have an excess of emotional empathy, but a deficit of cognitive empathy, and it also plays into the theory of the mind, the ability to imagine what somebody else is thinking or to predict what they're going to do and to respond to your environment, especially your social environment where other humans are involved. And something that I see that is so debilitating for the men that I love, my son and my husband, is that they have some paralyzing fears and anxieties sometimes, and they are so averse to conflict that they often won't enter into a situation for fear of a conflict, that in actuality, the conflict is likely to either be non-existent or much milder than they predict, and that failure to predict it accurately is based on that empathy deficit. And so I just wondered if you, if your speaker has any awareness of fear and how it plays out in the behavior manifestations of people on the autism spectrum.
You know, I can honestly say that that is not something that I've come across, but I would say that I think that that is a universal experience. I don't mean to say that what you're saying is not valid by any means, of course. But I do think that people getting into being averse from conflict, it kind of fits in with the worry that we talked about, where you have an idea of how things are going to play out, and even though in reality it almost never plays out that way. And, you know, that kind of worry is generally immune to reason. I mean, I talked earlier about airplanes and how you can give people all the statistics in the world about how safe airplane travel is, and the only thing that will get you over your fear of flying is actually getting in the plane. So I think in all cases, I cannot speak to autism, and I would hate to pretend like I know what I'm talking about to give advice for it. But, you know, I think that fear exists on a different channel, and if you can put yourself in those situations where even though it's uncomfortable, you are exposing yourself to something that you're afraid of, the amygdala is on its own little circuit. So, you know, I hope I'm not wrong, but in thinking that even they could probably benefit from exposing themselves to what makes them afraid and learning that, you know, it'll be fine after all, in a way that is beyond their conscious awareness, this process happens.
Thanks, Jill, for that call. We appreciate it. Real quick from Rachel on Facebook, because we're running out of time. I react to fear during a scary movie with giggling. It annoys my fellow movie watchers, but I can't control it. But real-life fear causes almost panic attacks in me.
Yeah, well, it's probably because scary movie fear isn't really fear. I mean, it is fear, but it's actually, it's kind of the same thing as the feeling that you get from being on a ride, you know, a roller coaster ride, where you have this contained fear. You know that you're safe.
Yeah.
So you get kind of this vicarious fear. And a lot of people, interestingly enough, enjoy watching scary movies because it kind of vicariously gives you the feeling that you are overcoming fear. You see this scary situation that the person's going through, and you are the master of it.
Taylor Clark, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Taylor Clark, he's the author of Nerve, Poise Under Pressure, Serenity Under Stress, and the Brave New Science of Fear and Cool. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.